All right. So, of course, you know, it's how Luke says, you know, the Sadducees, they deny the resurrection. Then he says, they start questioning Jesus about what's going to happen at the resurrection. Of course, Jesus is going, really? Really? But in any event, he does respond to them, and he doesn't belittle them except to say that they don't understand the scriptures. He says that in another account of the same thing. He says, you know, in heaven, heaven's not what we think. You know, we think heaven's going to be like this, and it is in one sense. It's going to be about relationships with others, but really, it's not going to be about golfing and fishing and all the other things that we're involved with here, because the fulfillment of our desire is God himself, who we'll see with our own eyes and who will experience his profound love for us and participate in the very life of God, so we'll have love for our neighbors. And so, you know, we can't, from our earthly experience, we can kind of maybe see through a fogged mirror that what it'll look like, but we really can't grasp it completely. But it will be in many ways similar to life in this world, but in many ways it won't. But the one thing that will shock us, or we'll see for our own eyes, is that God indeed is the God of the living, not the dead. And that's our resurrection hope. And so even though the Sadducees don't believe in the resurrection, Jesus is telling them the resurrection is real, because all are alive in the eyes of God. And that is our resurrection hope, right? That Jesus, who conquered death and rose on the 3 days, in Christ Jesus, we too will rise. But in order for that to happen, we have to live lives that are permeated with our faith. Our faith should be a part of every aspect of our life. And we see that in that first reading from Maccabees. So the historical background is this. So Alexander the Great, the great leader of the Greeks, he conquers the Mediterranean basin, subjecting a large portion of the Mediterranean basin to his rule. And so he goes through and he makes his way down from Greece, down along the eastern Mediterranean coast through Israel, and he eventually ends up down in Egypt. And while in Egypt, he's conquering Egypt, but he becomes ill. And he deathly ill. And so he calls his generals together and he splits up his kingdom between his generals. And so when Alexander dies, each of the generals goes back and makes themselves king in whatever area that Alexander gave. And what they did is they imposed the Greek culture and Greek religion upon the people, including in Israel. And many people in Israel, you know, this is, you know, people being who we are, even though they were, the Jewish people, God's people, they had experienced the Babylonian exile, came back on fire with faith. A couple hundred years go, 150 years go by, and lo and behold, they have no problem capitulating to the new king's demands. But many of them do, and that's what the book of Maccabees, the first and second book of Maccabees is about, is how Judas Maccabeus and those who allied themselves with him revolted against the Greek occupation and rule of their country. And that's what the story talks about. They wanted them to eat pork. Well, a faithful Jew would never eat pork. They wanted them to violate God's laws, and these were devout, zealous Jews. And there's seven brothers and their mother, and as it turns out, they all will die at the hands of the Greek soldiers because they will not compromise their faith, the practice of their faith, in being obedient to God's commandments and laws. Not even death. The threat of death will make them break God's laws. And that is a model for us. Now, we don't often think today because, you know, we here in the United States, you know, we've received the gospel for 2,000 years in a Western mode. And so in many respects, because of our culture and our affluence and everything else, we don't hear it like the first believers heard it. Because we have no experience, really, of what it's like to be a sheep herder. And so the images are kind of lost on us. And so in a real sense, maybe not for every person, but it affects us all to one degree or another. When we hear the gospel, it's a sterilized and neutered gospel. We just don't hear it with the immediacy of the response. And it really came to mind because I was reading an article about a priest who had gone to Africa, to Burundi, back in the early 80s, and then he went back around 2015. And the church in Africa is vibrant and alive. And he noticed, he was wondering, why is it so on fire? Because it's the same gospel, and people are people, we're sinners. And his analysis of it was this. He goes, the people in Burundi, the Africans there, their lifestyle and their culture is very similar to the first couple centuries of Gentiles who would have heard the gospel of Jesus Christ. They're tied to the rhythms of the lands, the cycle of the seasons. And so when they hear Jesus' words, plus the challenges of living in Africa with its, ethnic or tribal issues that arise regularly, when they hear the good news, they really hear it as Jesus speaking to them now, and they hear it as God teaching them. So we hear it as Jesus or the church telling us. So when we hear the gospel, it's social justice, it's outreach, and all these other things. But they hear it as literally Jesus himself speaking to them and saying, this is how you are to live. And they respond to it. It's very similar to St. Anthony of the Desert. St. Anthony of the Desert is the father of Western monasticism in the 300s. He was a young man in Egypt. His parents had died, and so he was taking care of the family farm and providing for his sister, and he was illiterate. And so he goes to church one day to go to Mass, and when he walks in the church, he hears the gospel. And the gospel that day was, sell everything and follow me. And it cut right through to Anthony's heart. And so he went home and he sold almost everything. He saved just a little bit because he had to provide for his sister, but he gave the rest away to the poor. He goes back to church the next day and, he's feeling good about, and he hears the gospel and Jesus says, why worry about tomorrow? Today has enough concerns of its own. And so he goes home and he sells the remainder of his farmlands and his possessions. And he takes the money and gives some to the poor. And he takes his sister and some of the money to a community of virgins who are living, Christian virgins, living in community. And he gives his sister to them for them to care for and continue raising, and he goes off to the desert to be a hermit. Now, how many of us here have heard the gospel like that and responded like that? But that's what's taking place in Africa today, because they really hear it as God himself speaking to them, and the truth is setting them free, and it changes their life because they begin to experience life in a new way, and their faith is on fire. And so what we need to do is to think about ourselves in the context of the first reading from Maccabees and what's happening in Africa with the church there and the challenges that we face as Christians in this modern world. Are we hearing Jesus' teachings and his commandments as God speaking to us now? Not 2,000 years ago, but God who is alive, the God of the living, speaking to you and me. And how are we responding to that word? Are we willing, like those seven brothers, to die for our faith rather than break one of Jesus' commandments. Are we allowing faith to permeate every aspect of our lives? Because we as Americans are very good at compartmentalizing. This is my family life. This is my work life. This is my hobbies. But see, faith is supposed to flow into every part of our life, every decision, every action. And that, you know, we see it in the lives of the saints, but we kind of give ourselves a pass because we're not hearing the gospel with the immediacy to make a response, to give our lives completely to Jesus. And then even when we give our lives and turn it over, surrender to the Lord, what we find out is there's always parts of our lives that we're holding back. And so that's what I want to speak about today, because this idea of faith being the compass that orients our life, being the energy that makes our life alive and vibrant, that's the kind of faith Jesus wants for all of us to have. And when we start working in response or cooperating, responding in response to that grace, our lives really have a profoundly different feel and look. And so this is important because the call to live our faith is going to be tested on Tuesday. Tuesday, there's an election. Elections are usually, you know, they're becoming more rancorous, but they've always been kind of rancorous, but more so now because there's fewer people of faith, and rather than having God as their religion, belief in God, politics has become their gods. And so that's why you have the Democrats saying, if the Republicans take power, the country is doomed and it's all going to be the end of the world. Well, likewise, the Republicans are saying, if the Democrats stay in power, it's the end of the world in our country as we know it. Okay, neither of them are right. But that's because people don't have God in their life, their new religion is politics. And there has to be a good guy and a bad guy, and that's just the way it is. So we got to pray about that and pray for our brothers and sisters. But on the ballot, there is a moral issue that our faith has to address, and that is Proposal 3. And so as your shepherd, I'm going to teach you about mortal sin. I'm going to teach you about Proposal 3 in light of it. So here's the thing about most Catholics. Most Catholics know there's mortal sin and venial sin, but a large proportion don't really know the distinctions and some of the things that are at play in moral theology. So it's safer just to say every sin is deadly. If you just have that, you're in a much better place anyways. But mortal sin separates us from God. That's why I say mortal. Venial sin strains the relationship, but mortal sin separates. So what constitutes a mortal sin? Well, first of all, objectively, I can say something has, it's grave matter, so it could be a mortal sin. But in truth, only the sinner and God know whether it's a mortal sin in fact. Because there are certain requirements that have to be met for it to be mortal. So the first requirement is it has to be grave matter. And traditionally, the church has three things that are of grave matter. First, it concerns the first commandment. There should be no other gods in one's life. Nothing should take precedence over God. That's the first grave matter. The second one has to do with life, the fifth commandment. Thou shalt not murder. Thou shalt not take an innocent life. And the third has to do with sexual morality. And that's for the sixth and ninth commandment. And basically what it is there is to be no sexual intimacy outside of marriage. So those are the three things traditionally the church looks at as being grave matters. So under the God one, under the first commandment would be apostasy, denying Jesus and the church. If we commit apostasy and deny the faith, that's grave matter. If we don't attend Mass on Sunday, the Sunday obligation, because that's the third commandment, keep the Sabbath holy, by not keeping our obligation, that is grave matter. Under murder is taking an innocent life, and so for those in the armed forces, those in war, it really does not apply because they are soldiers, and in most cases, they're not taking innocent life. But if you or I were to shoot our neighbor or our brother, that's taking an innocent life. Abortion falls under the grave matter of murder because an innocent life is taken. And from the early church, the church has always taught that abortion is a grave, grave evil. 2,000 years. It's written about in the early church writings in the first century. The fourth, the sexual morality, it deals with adultery and fornication and so on. So those are grave matter. Now, what constitutes a mortal sin in regards to the grave matter? There's four elements. One, the individual has to know that the action is evil and wrong. So it's understanding, knowledge. The second is the person has to freely choose to act in accord with that evil. So if you have a gun pointed to your head saying, you have to murder that person or I'm going to shoot, so you're not free, you're being coerced. Or if you're being pressured by family or someone else to have an abortion, you're not free, you're being coerced. So there's grave matter, there's understanding / knowledge, and there's freely choosing it. And then you have to will it. You have to will yourself to do it. And then the last requirement, of course, is you actually act on it. So why is it just, it doesn't stop at the will? Because I'll make fun of Tony. Where's Tony? He's over there. Tony irritates me a lot. Sometimes, Alan, you've heard it. I want to kill him. I freely choose it. I know it's wrong, and I'm willing it, but I don't do it. I've never done it, have I, Tony? You're here today. Proof. I've never done it. So there's no mortal sin because I didn't act on it. But here's how it applies to Proposal 3. Proposal 3 is about legalizing abortion in the state of Michigan. Grave matter. Abortion is evil. It's always wrong. Taking an innocent life, freely choosing to do it, willing it, and then acting on it. So this is how it affects one for you and I. So as a Catholic man or woman, we know these things to be true. This may be the first time you're hearing some of it, but these are things that are true. We accept that. So if we vote yes for Proposal 3, it's not like voting for a politician who may not hold have all the things that we want in our politician to be. They may be for this thing that we have concerns about. They may be for this, and we have concerns about because it's not in agreement with our faith. But the politician, we're not voting for that particular politician for this particular reason. We got a slate of things that we weigh. But for Proposal 3, it is concretely voting for evil. And so if, as a Catholic, we vote for Proposal 3, yes, and it passes and it becomes part of our amendment, of our law of the state, the first person who goes and gets an abortion under that new law, we are material cooperators in evil. And because we're material cooperators in that evil, knowing all the things, we knew it was grave matter, we knew it was wrong, we freely did it, we willed it, and we actually voted in accord with it, you and I are guilty of a mortal sin. It is as if you and I drove the individual to the abortion clinic to have the abortion, or participated in the operating room itself in the abortion. That's what it means to be a material cooperator in moral evil. That is classic Catholic moral theology. As a shepherd, I have a responsibility to teach the faith. Because if I see God's flock heading down a road in deep fog and I know the bridge is out ahead, I have a responsibility and duty to say, hey, stop, the bridge is out. If I see Catholics heading towards a precipice of mortal sin, I have a responsibility and duty to teach and to warn the faithful. I do it out of the virtue of charity. But there's also a second, very selfish reason. One day I'll have to stand before the Lord and give an account of my ministry, what I did do and what I didn't do. And if I did not warn the flock about dangers, I would not be doing my job as a shepherd. Now, many priests, I'm sure, throughout the state will never tell their people these things. They'll do them for many different reasons. But that's on them, not on me. I share this with you because it is of great importance. Because if this becomes part of our Constitution, it will affect probably several generations before we see the carnage that comes. But it's about faith. Is faith the compass that directs our lives, or are we being influenced by the culture? Are we being influenced by the world? Are we hearing Jesus' teachings to love God with all our heart, with all our soul, and all our strength, and to love our neighbor as ourself, as commandments coming from the very mouth of God himself, because Jesus is God? You see, we as Americans, we tend to hear these like Italians hear it, because they're notorious for this too. Well, those are suggestions. Do you really think God suggests? No, he gives us these things because these things will bring us life in all its fullness. So we need to be aware of these things and be mindful of these things when Tuesday comes up. But there's going to be all kinds of things like this in the future, not just in the political realm, but all throughout our culture, because this is a time of great darkness. And we'll have to look within ourselves and act as people of faith, like those in the book of Maccabees, and like throughout the history of the church. So I would encourage us to pray about these things and ask the Lord for the grace to be courageous, to be bold in sharing the truth. And like I said, I can't tell who's in mortal sin, but I do know when we're in mortal sin or venial sin, I know where to go, to Jesus and the sacrament of reconciliation, because he came to reconcile sinners to his Father. He came to give life. He's entrusted his church with the same mission. It's not mine to condemn. It's mine to give warning and then to reconcile sinners who get off track. And we're all sinners. And we all get off track once in a while. So let us be mindful of these things. Let us pray for an increase and a renewal in faith in the church, because our nation and our world desperately needs the church today. because it needs to hear the good news. It needs to hear the truth that leads to life. And that life is the incarnate Son of God, Jesus Christ. For he is the resurrection and the life.